I did glance at Jamie this time. He still held the dirk, but his hand had fallen to his side and his shoulders had lost a little of their tension. He smiled at me again, and this time I returned it. Jamie was awake but drowsy. He made no objection to the oil, but startled at the cold touch of the whiskey on his forehead, eyes popping open and arms flinging wide. He uttered a high-pitched eep of protest, then, as Bree gathered him hastily up into his blanket against her shoulder, screwed up his face and tried to decide whether he was sufficiently disturbed to cry about it. Bree patted his back like a bongo drum and made little hooting noises in his ear, distracting him. He settled for plugging his mouth with a thumb and glowering suspiciously at the assemblage, but by that time Father Kenneth was already pouring whiskey on the sleeping Joan, held low in Masali's arms.
"I baptise thee, Joan, Lyra, Clare, Fraser," he said, following Masali's lead.
And I glanced at Masali, startled. I knew she was called Joan for Masali's younger sister, but I hadn't known what the baby's other names would be. I felt a small lump in my throat watching Masali's shawled head bent over the child. Both her sister and her mother, Lyra, were in Scotland. The chances of either ever seeing this tiny namesake were vanishingly small. Suddenly, Joan's slanted eyes popped wide open, and so did her mouth. She let out a piercing shriek, and everyone started as though a bomb had exploded in our midst.
"Go in peace to serve the Lord, and go fast," Father Kenneth said,
his fingers already nimbly corking up bottle and flask, frantically whisking away all traces of the ceremony. Down the path I could hear voices raised in puzzled question. Masali was out the tent flap in a flash, the squalling Joan against her breast, a protesting Germaine clutched by the hand. Bree paused just long enough to put a hand behind Father Kenneth's head and kiss him on the forehead. "Thank you, Father," she whispered, and was gone in a flurry of skirts and petticoats. Jamie had me by the arm and was hustling me out of the tent as well, but stopped for a half-second at the door, turning back.
"Father," he called in a whisper, "Pax vobiscum."
Father Kenneth had already seated himself behind the table, hands folded, the accusing sheets of blank paper spread out once more before him. He looked up, smiling slightly, and his face was perfectly at peace in the lamplight, black eye and all.
"Et cum spiritu tuo, man," he said,
and raised three fingers in parting benediction.
"What on earth did you do that for?"
Brianna's whisper floated back to me, loud with annoyance. She and Masali were only a few feet in front of us, going slowly because of the children. But close as they were, the girls' shawled and bunchy shapes were scarcely distinguishable from the bushes overgrowing the path.
"Do what? Leave that, Jermaine. Let's find Papa, shall we? No, don't put it in your mouth. You pinched Joanie. I saw you. You could have got us all caught."
"But I had to." Masali sounded surprised at the accusation. "And it wouldn't have mattered, really. The christening was done by then. They couldn't have made Father Kenneth take it back now, could they?" She giggled slightly at the thought, then broke off.
"Jermaine, I said drop it."
"What do you mean you had to?
Let go, Jem, that's my hair. Ow! Let go, I said."
Jemmy was evidently now wide awake, interested in the novel surroundings and wanting to explore them, judging from his repeated exclamations of "Ah!" punctuated by the occasional curious "Glep!"
"Why, she was asleep," Masali said, sounding scandalised.
"She didn't awake when Father Kenneth poured the water, I mean the whisky, on her head."
"Jermaine, come back here. Higgerash a show."
"And ye ken it's ill luck for a child not to make a wee skellach when it's baptised. That's how ye ken as the original sin is leaving it. I couldn't let the dear ball stay in my wee lassie, could I, Mom of Oreen?" There were small kissing noises and a faint coo from Joanie, promptly drowned by Jermaine, who'd started to sing again. Bree gave a small snort of amusement, her irritation fading.
"Oh, I see. Well, as long as you had a good reason. Though I'm not so sure it worked on Jemmy and Jermaine. Look at the way they're acting. I'd swear they were possessed. Ow! Don't bite me, you little fiend. I'll feed you in a minute. Oh, well, they're boys, after all, Masali said tolerantly, raising her voice slightly to be heard above the racket. Everyone kens that boys are full of the devil. I suppose it would take more than a bit of holy water to drown it all, even if it was 90 proof. Jermaine, where did you hear such a filthy song, you wee ratten? I smiled, and next to me Jamie laughed quietly, listening to the girls' conversation. We were far enough from the scene of the crime by now not to worry about being heard among the snatches of song, fiddle music and laughter that flickered through the trees with the light of the campfires bright against the growing dark. The business of the day was largely done, and folk were settling down to the evening meal before the calling, the singing and the last round of visits started. The scents of smoke and supper trailed tantalizing fingers through the cold, dark air, and my stomach rumbled gently in answer to their summons. I hoped Lizzie was sufficiently restored as to have begun cooking. "What's momovoreen?" I asked Jamie. "I haven't heard that one before."
"It means my wee potato, I think," he said. "It's Irish, aye. She learned it from the priest."
He sighed, sounding deeply satisfied with the evening's work so far.
"May bride bless Father Kenneth for a nimble-fingered man. For a moment, I thought we wouldn't manage it. Is that Roger and wee Fergus?"
A couple of dark shadows had come out of the wood to join the girls, and the sound of muffled laughter and murmured voices, punctuated by raucous shrieks from both little boys at the sight of their daddies, drifted back to us from the little knot of young families.
"It is. And speaking of that, my little sweet potato," I said, taking a firm grip of his arm to slow him, "what do you mean by telling Father Kenneth all that about me and the butter churn?"
"You didn't mean to say you minded, Sassenach,"
he said in tones of surprise.
"Of course I minded," I said.
The blood rose warm in my cheeks, though I wasn't sure whether this was due to the memory of his confession or to the memory of the original occasion. My innards warmed slightly at that thought as well, and the last remnants of cramp began to subside as my womb clenched and relaxed, eased by the pleasant inward glow. It was scarcely a suitable time or place, but perhaps later in the evening we might manage sufficient privacy. I pushed the thought hastily aside.
"Privacy quite aside, it wasn't a sin at all," I said primly. "We were married, for goodness sake."
"Well, I did confess to telling lies, Sassenach," he said.
I couldn't see the smile on his face, but I could hear it well enough in his voice. I supposed he could hear mine, too.
"I had to think of a sin frightful enough to drive Lilywhite away, and I couldn't have confessed to theft or buggery. I may have to do business with the man one day."
"Oh, so you think he'd be put off by sodomy, but he'd consider your attitude toward women in wet chemises just a minor flaw of character?"
His arm was warm under the cloth of his shirt. I touched the underside of his wrist, that vulnerable place where the skin lay bare, and stroked the line of the vein that pulsed there, disappearing under the linen toward his heart.
"Keep your voice down, Sassenach," he murmured, touching my hand. "You didn't want the bairns to hear you. Besides," he added,
his voice dropping low enough that he was obliged to lean down and whisper in my ear,
"it's not all women. Only the ones with lovely round asses."
He let go my hand and patted my backside familiarly, showing remarkable accuracy in the darkness.
"I wouldn't cross the road to see a scrawny woman if she were stark naked and dripping wet." "As for Lilywhite," he resumed, in a more normal tone of voice, but without removing his hand, which was moulding the cloth of my skirt thoughtfully round one buttock, "he may be a Protestant, Sassenach, but he's still a man." "I didn't realise the two states were incompatible," Roger's voice said dryly, coming out of the darkness nearby.
Jamie snatched his hand away as though my bottom were on fire. It wasn't, quite, but there was no denying that his flint had struck a spark or two among the kindling, damp as it was.
"It was a long time before bedtime, though." pausing just long enough to administer a brief private squeeze to Jamie's anatomy that made him gasp sharply, I turned to find Roger clasping a large wriggling object in his arms, its nature obscured by the dark. Not a piglet, I surmised, despite the loud grunting noises it was making, but rather Jemmy, who seemed to be gnawing fiercely on his father's knuckles. A small pink fist shot out into a random patch of light, clenched in concentration, then disappeared, meeting Roger's ribs with a solid thump. Jamie gave a small grunt of amusement himself, but wasn't discomposed in the slightest by having his opinion of Protestants overheard.
"All are good lasses," he quoted in broad Scots, "but where do the ill wives come frae?"
"Eh?" Roger said, sounding a bit bewildered.
"Protestants are born wi' pricks," Jamie explained, "the men at least. But some let them wither from disuse. A man who spends his time poking his nose into others' sinfulness has nae time to tend his own."
I converted a laugh into a more tactful cough.
"And some just become bigger pricks, what with the practice," Roger said more dryly still. "Aye, well. I come to thank you for managing about the baptism, I mean."
I noticed the slight hesitation. He still hadn't settled on any comfortable name by which to call Jamie to his face. Jamie addressed him impartially as Wee Roger, Roger Mac, or Mackenzie, more rarely by the Gaelic nickname Ronnie Sinclair had given Roger, in honour of his voice. It meant singing thrush.
"It's me should be thanking you, Harwich. We shouldn't have managed there at the last, save for you and Fergus," Jamie said,
laughter warming his own voice. Roger was clearly visible in outline, tall and lean, with the glow of someone's fire behind him. One shoulder rose as he shrugged, and he shifted Jemmy to his other arm, wiping residual drool from his hand against the side of his breeches.
"No trouble," he said, a little gruffly. "Will the father be all right, d'you think? Brianna said he'd been roughly handled. I hope they'll not mistreat him once he's away."
Jamie sobered at that. He shrugged a little as he straightened the coat on his shoulders.
"I think he'll be safe enough, I had a word with the sheriff."
There was a certain grim emphasis on word that made his meaning clear. A substantial bribe might have been more effective, but I was well aware that we had exactly 2 shillings, 3d, and 9 farthings in cash to our names at the moment. Better to save the money and rely on threats, I thought. Evidently, Jamie was of the same mind.
"I shall speak to my aunt," he said, "and have her send a note tonight to Mr. Lillywhite, wi' her own opinion on the subject. That'll be a better safeguard for Father Kenneth than anything I can say myself."
"I don't suppose she'll be at all pleased to hear that her wedding is postponed," I observed. She wouldn't be. Daughter of a Highland laird and widow of a very rich planter, Jocasta Cameron was used to having her own way.
"No, she won't," Jamie agreed wryly. "Though I suppose Duncan may be a bit relieved."
Roger laughed, not without sympathy, and fell in beside us as we started down the path. He shifted Jemmy, still grunting ferociously, under his arm like a football.
"Aye, hey, well, poor Duncan. So the weddings are definitely off, are they?"
I couldn't see Jamie's frown, but I felt the movement as he shook his head doubtfully.
"Aye, I'm afraid so. They wouldna give the priest to me, even with my word to hand him over in the morning. We could maybe take him by force, but even so..."
"I doubt that would help." I interrupted and told them what I had overheard while waiting outside the tent. "So I can't see them standing around and letting Father Kenneth perform marriages," I finished. "Even if you got him away, they'd be combing the mountains for him, turning out tents and causing riots." "Sheriff Anstruther wouldn't be without aid. Jamie and his aunt might be held in good esteem among the Scottish community, but Catholics in general, and priests in particular, weren't."
"Instructions?"
Jamie repeated, sounding astonished.
"You're sure of it, Sassenach? It was Lillywhite who said he had instructions."
"It was," I said, realising for the first time how peculiar that was. The sheriff was plainly taking instructions from Mr. Lillywhite, that being his duty. But who could be giving instructions to the magistrate?
There's another magistrate here and a couple of justices of the peace, but surely...
Roger said slowly, shaking his head as he thought.
A loud squawk interrupted his thoughts, and he glanced down, the light from a nearby fire shining off the bridge of his nose, outlining a faint smile as he spoke to his offspring.
What? You're hungry, laddie? Don't fret yourself. Mummy will be back soon.
Where is Mummy?
I said, peering into the shifting mass of shadows ahead. A light wind had risen, and the bare branches of oak and hickory rattled like sabres overhead.
Still, Jemmy was more than loud enough for Brianna to hear him.
I caught Masali's voice faintly up ahead, engaged in what appeared to be amiable conversation with Germaine and Fergus regarding supper. But there was no sound of Bree's lower, huskier Boston bread tones.
Why?
Jamie said to Roger, raising his voice to be heard over the wind.
Why what? Here's Jem, see that, won't it? Aye, of course you do. Yes, good lad, gnaw on that for a bit.
A spark of light caught something shiny in Roger's free hand, then the object disappeared, and Jemmy's cries ceased abruptly, succeeded by loud sucking and slurping noises.
"What's that? It isn't small enough for him to swallow, is it?"
I asked anxiously.
"Oh, no, it's a watch chain. Not to worry,"
Roger assured me. "I've a good grip on the end of it. If he swallows it, I can pull it back out."
"Why would someone not want you to be married?"
Jamie said patiently, ignoring the imminent danger to his grandson's digestive system.
Me?
Roger sounded surprised.
I shouldn't think anyone cares whether I'm married or not, save myself. And you, perhaps, he added, a touch of humour in his voice. I expect you'd like the boy to have a name.
Speaking of that,
he turned to me, the wind pulling long streamers of his hair loose and turning him into a wild black fiend in silhouette.
What did he end up being named? At the christening, I mean.
Jeremiah Alexander Ian Fraser Mackenzie, I said, hoping I recalled it correctly. Is that what you wanted?
Oh, I didn't mind so much what he was called,
Roger said, edging gingerly round a large puddle that spread across the path. It had begun to sprinkle again. I could feel small, chilly drops on my face and see the dimpling of the water in the puddle where the firelight shone across it.
I wanted Jeremiah, but I told Bree the other names were up to her. She couldn't quite decide between John for John Grey and Ian for her cousin. But of course they're the same name in any case.
Again I noticed the faint hesitation, and I felt Jamie's arm stiffen slightly under my hand. Jamie's nephew Ian was a sore point, and fresh in everyone's mind, thanks to the note we had received from him the day before. That must be what had decided Brianna at last.
"Well, if it isn't you and my daughter,"
Jamie pursued doggedly,
"then who is it? Jocasta and Duncan? Or the folk from Bremerton?"
"You think someone's out specially to prevent the marriages tonight?"
Roger seized the opportunity to talk about something other than Ian Murray.
"You don't think it's just general dislike of Romish practices, then?" "There might be, but it's not. If it were, why wait till now to arrest the priest? Wait a bit, Sassenach, I'll fetch you over."
Jamie let go of my hand and stepped around the puddle and then reached back, grabbed me by the waist and lifted me bodily across in a swish of skirts. The wet leaves slipped and squelched under my boots as he set me down, but I seized his arm for balance, righting myself.
"No," Jamie continued the conversation, turning back toward Roger. "Lily White and Anne Struther have no great love of Catholics, I expect. But why stir up a stramash now, when the priest would be gone in the morning anyway? Do they maybe think he'll corrupt all the God-fearing folk on the mountain before dawn if they dinna keep him in ward?"
Roger gave a short laugh at that.
"No, I suppose not. Is there anything else the priest was meant to do tonight, beyond performing marriages and baptisms?"
"Perhaps a few confessions," I said, pinching Jamie's arm. "Nothing else that I know of."
I squeezed my thighs together, feeling an alarming shift in my intimate arrangements. Damn! One of the pins holding the cloth between my legs had come loose when Jamie lifted me. Had I lost it?
I don't suppose they'll be trying to keep him from hearing someone's confession. Someone in particular, I mean.
Roger sounded doubtful, but Jamie took the idea and turned it around in his hands, considering.
They'd no objection to his hearing mine. And I shouldn't think they'd care if a Catholic was in mortal sin or not, as by their lights we're all damned anyway. But if they kept someone desperately needed confession, and they thought there was something to be gained by it.
That whoever it was might pay for access to the priest? I asked sceptically.
Really, Jamie, these are Scots. I should imagine that if it were a question of paying out hard money for a priest, your Scottish Catholic murderer or adulterer would just say an act of contrition and hope for the best.
Jamie snorted slightly, and I saw the white mist of his breath purl round his head like candle smoke. It was getting colder.
I dare say, he said dryly. And if Lilywhite had any thought of setting up in the confession business, he's left it a bit late in the day to make much profit. But what if it wasn't a matter of stopping someone's confession, but rather only of making sure that they overheard it?
Roger uttered a pleased grunt, evidently thinking this a promising supposition.
Blackmail. Aye, that's a thought, he said with approval. Blood will out, I thought.
Oxford educated or not, there was little doubt that Roger was a Scot. There was a violent upheaval under his arm, followed by a wail from Jimmy. Roger glanced down.
Oh, did you drop your bobby? Where's it going, then?
He hooked Jimmy up onto his shoulder like a bundle of laundry and squatted down, poking at the ground in search of the watch chain which Jimmy had evidently hurled into the darkness.
Blackmail? I think that's a trifle far-fetched, I objected, rubbing a hand under my nose which had begun to drip.
You mean they might suspect that Farquhar Campbell, for instance, had committed some dreadful crime, and if they knew about it for sure, they could hold him up about it? Isn't that awfully devious thinking?
If you find a pin down there, Roger, it's mine.
Well, Lilywhite and Anstruther are Englishmen, are they not?
Jamie said, with a delicate sarcasm that made Roger laugh.
Deviousness and double-dealing come naturally to that race, no, Sassenach?
Oh, rubbish, I said tolerantly. Pot calling the kettle black, isn't it? Besides, they didn't try to overhear your confession.
I haven't got anything to be blackmailed for, Jamie pointed out, though it was perfectly obvious that he was only arguing for the fun of it.
Even so, I began,
but was interrupted by Jimmy, who was becoming increasingly restive, flinging himself to and fro with intermittent steam-whistle shrieks. Roger grunted, pinched something gingerly between his fingers, and stood up.
Found your pin, he said. No sign of the chain, though.
"Someone will find it in the morning," I said, raising my voice to be heard over the increasing racket. "Perhaps you'd better let me take him."
I reached for the baby, and Roger surrendered his burden with a distinct air of relief, explained when I got a whiff of Jemmy's diaper.
"Not again," I said.
Apparently, taking this as a personal reproach, he shut his eyes and started to howl like an air raid siren.
"Where is Bree?"
I asked, trying simultaneously to cradle him reassuringly and to keep him at a sanitary distance.
"Ouch!"
He seemed to have taken advantage of the darkness to grow a number of extra limbs, all of which were flailing or grabbing.
"Oh, she's just gone to run a wee errand," Roger said, with an air of vagueness that made Jamie turn his head sharply.
The light caught him in profile, and I saw the thick red brows drawn down in suspicion. Fire gleamed off the long, straight bridge of his nose as he lifted it, questioning.
Obviously, he smelled a rat.
He turned toward me, one eyebrow lifted. Was I in on it?
I haven't any idea, I assured him.
Here, I'm going across to MacAllister's fire to borrow a clean clout. I'll see you at our camp in a bit.
Not waiting for an answer, I took a firm grasp on the baby and shuffled into the bushes, heading for the nearest campsite. Georgiana McAllister had newborn twins. I'd delivered them 4 days before, and was happy to provide me with both a clean diaper and a private bush behind which to effect my personal repairs. These accomplished, I chatted with her and admired the twins, all the while wondering about the recent revelations. Between Lieutenant Hayes and his proclamation, the machinations of Lilywhite and company, and whatever Bree and Roger were up to, the mountains seemed a perfect hotbed of conspiracy tonight. I was pleased that we had managed the christening. In fact, I was surprised to find just how gratified I did feel about it. But I had to admit to a pang of distress over Brianna's cancelled wedding. She hadn't said much about it, but I knew that both she and Roger had been looking forward very much to the blessing of their union. The firelight winked briefly, accusingly, off the gold ring on my left hand, and I mentally threw up my hands in Frank's direction. "And just what do you expect me to do about it?" I demanded silently, while externally agreeing with Georgiana's opinion on the treatment of pinworms.
This ends Disc 7. The Fiery Cross, Disc 8.
"Mum," one of the older McAllister girls who had volunteered to change Jemmy, interrupted the conversation, dangling a long, slimy object delicately between two fingers. "I found this gourd in the wainscoot. Is it maybe your man's?" "Good grief!" I was shocked by the watch chain's reappearance, but a moment's rationality corrected my first alarmed impression that Jemmy had, in fact, swallowed the thing. It would take several hours for a solid object to make its way through even the most active infant's digestive tract. Evidently, he had merely dropped his toy down the front of his gown, and it had come to rest in his diaper. "Get here, lass." Mr. McAllister, catching sight of the watch chain, reached out and took it with a slight grimace. He pulled a large handkerchief from the waist of his breeks and wiped the object carefully, bringing to light the gleam of silver links and a small round fob bearing some kind of seal. I noted the fob with some grimness and made a mental resolve to give Roger a proper bollocking about what he let Jemmy put in his mouth. Thank goodness it hadn't come off. "Why, that's Mr. Caldwell's wee gourd, surely." Georgiana leaned forward, peering over the heads of the twins she was nursing. "Is it?" Her husband squinted at the object and fumbled in his shirt for his spectacles. "Aye, I'm sure it is. I saw it when he preached Sunday. The first of my pains was just coming on," she explained, turning to me, "and I had to come away before he'd finished. He saw me turn to go and must have thought he'd outstayed his welcome, for he pulled the watch from his pocket to have a wee geek, and I saw the glint from that bitty round thing on the chain." "That's called a seal anion," her husband informed her, having now settled a pair of half-moon spectacles firmly atop his nose and turning the small metal emblem over between his fingers. "You're right, though. It's Mr. Caldwell's, for see." A horny finger traced the outline of the figure on the seal, a mace, an open book, a bell and a tree, standing on top of a fish with a ring in its mouth. "That's from the University of Glasgow, that is. Mr. Caldwell's a scholar," he told me, blue eyes wide with awe. "Been to learn the preaching, and a fine job he makes of it." "You did miss a fine finish, Georgie," he added, turning to his wife. "He went so red in the face, talking of the abomination of desolation and the wrath at world's end, that I thought surely he'd have an apoplexy. And then what should we do? For he wouldn't have Murray MacLeod to him. Murray being in the way of a heretic to Mr. Caldwell. He's New Light Murray," Mr. McAllister explained in an aside to me. "And Mrs. Fraser here, a papist, as well as being otherwise engaged with you and the bairns." He leaned over and patted one of the twins gently on its bonneted head, but it paid no attention, blissfully absorbed in its suckling. "Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Caldwell could have burst himself for all I cared at the time," his wife said frankly. She hitched up her double armload and settled herself more comfortably.
I'm for myself.
I shouldn't have much mind if the midwife were a Red Indian or English.
Oh, I do beg your pardon, Mrs. Fraser.
So long as she kent how to catch a beeb and stop the bleeding.
I murmured something modest, brushing away Georgiana's apologies in favour of finding out more about the watch chain's origins.
Mr. Caldwell, he's a preacher, you say?
A certain suspicion was stirring in the back of my mind.
Oh, aye, the best I've heard, Mr. McAllister assured me, and I've heard them all. No, Mr. Urmston, he's a grand one for the sins, but he's on in years and gone a bit hoarse now, so as you need to be right up front to hear him. And that's a bit dangerous, you ken, as it's the folk in front whose sins he's likely to start in upon. The new light fellow, though, he's nae much, no voice to him.
He dismissed the unfortunate preacher with the scorn of a connoisseur.
Mr. Woodmason's all right. A bit stiff in his manner. An Englishman, aye, but very faithful about turning up for services, for all he's well stricken in years. Now, young Mr. Campbell from the barbecue church.
This wean's fair starved, ma'am,
the girl holding Jemmy put in. Evidently so, he was red in the face and keening.
Will I give him a bit of porridge, maybe?
I gave a quick glance at the pot over the fire. It was bubbling, so likely well cooked enough to kill most germs. I pulled out the horn spoon I carried in my pocket, which I could be sure was reasonably clean, and handed it to the girl.
Thank you so much. Now, this Mr. Caldwell, he wouldn't by chance be a Presbyterian, would he?
Mr. McAllister looked surprised, then beamed at my perceptivity.
Why, so he is indeed. You'll have heard of him then, Mrs. Fraser.
I think perhaps my son-in-law is acquainted with him, I said, with a tinge of irony. Georgiana laughed.
I should say your grandson kens him, at least.
She nodded at the chain draped across her husband's broad palm.
Bairns that size are just like magpies. They'll seize upon any shiny bauby they see.
So they do, I said slowly, staring at the silver links and their dangling fob.
That put something of a different complexion on the matter. If Jemmy had picked Mr. Caldwell's pocket, it had obviously been done some time before Jamie had arranged the impromptu christening.
But Bree and Roger had known about Father Kenneth's arrest and the possible cancellation of their wedding well before that. There would have been plenty of time for them to make other plans while Jamie and I were dealing with Rosamond, Ronnie, and the other assorted crises. Plenty of time for Roger to go and talk to Mr. Caldwell, the Presbyterian minister, with Jemmy along for the ride. And as soon as Roger had confirmed the unlikelihood of the priests performing any marriages tonight, Brianna had disappeared on a vague errand.
Well, if Father Kenneth had wanted to interview a Presbyterian groom before marrying him, I suppose Mr. Caldwell might be allowed the same privilege with a prospective Papist bride.
Jemmy was devouring porridge with the single-mindedness of a starving piranha. We couldn't leave quite yet.
That was just as well, I thought. Let Brianna break the news to her father that she would have her wedding after all, priest or no priest.
I spread out my skirt to dry the damp hem, and the firelight glowed from both my rings. A strong disposition to laugh bubbled up inside me at the thought of what Jamie would say when he found out. But I suppressed it, not wanting to explain my amusement to the McAllisters.
"Shall I take that?"
I said instead to Mr. McAllister, with a nod toward the watch chain.
"I think perhaps I shall be seeing Mr. Caldwell a little later."
Chapter 14. Happy the bride the moon shines on.
We were lucky. The rain held off, and shredding clouds revealed a silver moon, rising lopsided but luminous over the slope of Black Mountain, suitable illumination for an intimate family wedding. I had met David Caldwell, though I hadn't recalled it until I saw him, a small but immensely personable gentleman, very tidy in his dress, despite camping in the open for a week. Jamie knew him too, and respected him.
That didn't prevent a certain tightness of expression as the minister came into the firelight, his worn prayer book clasped in his hands. But I nudged Jamie warningly, and he at once altered his expression to one of inscrutability. I saw Roger glance once in our direction, then turn back to Bree. There might have been a slight smile at the corner of his mouth, or it could have been only the effect of the shadows. Jamie exhaled strongly through his nose, and I nudged him again.
"You had your way over the baptism," I whispered.
He lifted his chin slightly. Brianna glanced in our direction, looking slightly anxious.
"I haven't said a word, have I?"
"It's a perfectly respectable Christian marriage."
"Did I say it was not?"
"Then look happy, damn you," I hissed.
He exhaled once more and assumed an expression of benevolence, one degree short of outright imbecility.
"Better?"
he asked, teeth clenched in a genial smile. I saw Duncan Innes turn casually toward us, start, and turn hastily away, murmuring something to Jocasta, who stood near the fire, white hair shining, and a blindfold over her damaged eyes to shield them from the light.
Ulysses, standing behind her, had in fact put on his wig in honour of the ceremony.
It was all I could see of him in the darkness, hanging apparently disembodied in the air above her shoulder. As I watched, it turned sideways toward us, and I caught the faint shine of eyes beneath it.
"Who that, grand-mère?"
Germaine, escaped as usual from parental custody, popped up near my feet, pointing curiously at the Reverend Caldwell.
"That's a minister, darling. Auntie Bree and Uncle Roger are getting married." "Qu'est-ce que c'est, minister?"
I drew a deep breath, but Jamie beat me to it.
"As a sort of a priest, but not a proper priest."
"Bad priest?"
Germaine viewed the Reverend Caldwell with substantially more interest.
"No, no," I said. "He's not a bad priest at all. It's only that... Well, you see, we're Catholics, and Catholics have priests, but Uncle Roger is a Presbyterian."
"That's a heretic,"
Jamie put in helpfully.
"It is not a heretic, darling. Grandpère is being funny, or thinks he is. Presbyterians are..."
Germaine was paying no attention to my explanation, but instead had tilted his head back, viewing Jamie with fascination.
"Why, Grandpère is making faces?"
"We're very happy,"
Jamie explained, expression still fixed in a rictus of amiability.
"Oh."
Germaine at once stretched his own extraordinarily mobile face into a crude facsimile of the same expression. A jack-o'-lantern grin, teeth clenched and eyes popping.
"Like this?"
"Yes, darling," I said in a marked tone. "Just like that." Marsali looked at us, blinked, and tugged at Fergus's sleeve. He turned, squinting at us.
"Look happy, Papa,"
Germaine pointed to his gigantic smile.
"See?"
Fergus's mouth twitched as he glanced from his offspring to Jamie. His face went blank for a moment, then adjusted itself into an enormous smile of white-toothed insincerity. Marsali kicked him in the ankle. He winced, but the smile didn't waver. Brianna and Roger were having a last-minute conference with Reverend Caldwell on the other side of the fire. Brianna turned from this, brushing back her loose hair, saw the phalanx of grinning faces and stared, her mouth slightly open. Her eyes went to me. I shrugged helplessly. Her lips pressed tight together, but curved upward, irrepressibly. Her shoulders shook with suppressed laughter. I felt Jamie quiver next to me. Reverend Caldwell stepped forward, a finger in his book at the proper place, put his spectacles on his nose, and smiled genially at the assemblage, blinking only slightly when he encountered the row of leering countenances. He coughed and opened his book of common worship.
"Dearly beloved, we are assembled here in the presence of God."
I felt Jamie relax slightly as the words went on, evidencing unfamiliarity perhaps, but no great peculiarities. I suppose that he had, in fact, never taken part in a Protestant ceremony before. unless one counted the impromptu baptism Roger himself had conducted among the Mohawk. I closed my eyes and sent a brief prayer upward for young Ian, as I did whenever I thought of him.
Let us therefore reverently remember that God has established and sanctified marriage for the welfare and happiness of mankind.
Opening them, I saw that all eyes now were focused on Roger and Brianna, who stood facing each other, hands entwined. They were a handsome pair, nearly of a height, she bright and he dark, like a photograph and its negative. Their faces were nothing alike, and yet both had the bold bones and clean curves that were their joint legacy from the Clan Mackenzie. I glanced across the fire to see the same echo of bone and flesh in Jocasta, tall and handsome, her blind face turned in absorption toward the sound of the minister's voice. As I watched, I saw her hand reach out and rest on Duncan's arm, the long white fingers gently squeeze. The Reverend Caldwell had kindly offered to perform their marriage as well, but Jocasta had refused, wishing to wait instead for a Catholic ceremony.
"We're in no great hurry, after all, are we, my dear?" she had asked Duncan, turning toward him with an outward exhibition of deference that fooled no one.
Still, I thought that Duncan had seemed relieved rather than disappointed by the postponement of his own wedding.
"By his apostles, he has instructed those who enter into this relation to cherish a mutual esteem and love."
Duncan had put a hand over Jocasta's with a surprising air of tenderness.
"That marriage wouldn't be one of love," I thought.
"But mutual esteem?" "Yes. I thought there was that."
"I charge you both before the great God, the searcher of all hearts, that if either of you know any reason why you may not lawfully be joined together in marriage, you do now confess it. For be ye well assured that if any persons are joined together otherwise than as God's word allows, their union is not blessed by him."
Reverend Caldwell paused, glancing warningly back and forth between Roger and Brianna. Roger shook his head slightly, his eyes fixed on Bree's face. She smiled faintly in response, and the Reverend cleared his throat and continued. The air of muted hilarity around the fire had subsided. There was no sound but the Reverend's quiet voice and the crackle of the flames.
"Roger Jeremiah, wilt thou have this woman to be thy wife? And wilt thou pledge thy troth to her, in all love and honour, in all duty and service, in all faith and tenderness, to live with her and cherish her, according to the ordinance of God, in the holy bond of marriage?"
"I will,"
Roger said, his voice deep and husky. I heard a deep sigh to my right, and saw Massali lean her head on Fergus's shoulder, a dreamy look on her face. He turned his head and kissed her brow, then leaned his own dark head against the whiteness of her kerch. "I will," Brianna said clearly, lifting her chin and looking up into Roger's face in response to the minister's question. Mr. Caldwell looked benevolently round the circle, firelight glinting on his spectacles.
"Who givest this woman to be married to this man?"
There was the briefest of pauses, and I felt Jamie jerk slightly, taken by surprise. I squeezed his arm, and saw the firelight gleam on the gold ring on my hand.
"Oh, I do, to be sure," he said.
Brianna turned her head and smiled at him, her eyes dark with love. He gave her back the smile, then blinked, clearing his throat and squeezed my hand hard. I felt a slight tightening of the throat myself as they spoke their vows, remembering both of my own weddings.
And Jocasta, I wondered. She'd been married 3 times. What echoes of the past did she hear in these words? "Aye, Roger Jeremiah, take thee, Brianna Ellen, to be my wedded wife."
The light of memory shone on most of the faces around the fire. The bugs stood close together, looking at each other with identical gazes of soft devotion. Mr. Weems, standing by his daughter, bowed his head and closed his eyes, a look of mingled joy and sadness on his face, no doubt thinking of his own wife, dead these many years.
In plenty and in want.
In joy and in sorrow.
In sickness and in health.
Lizzie's face was rapt, eyes wide at the mystery being carried out before her. How soon might it be her turn to stand before witnesses and make such awesome promises? Jamie reached across and took my right hand in his fingers linking with mine, and the silver of my ring shone red in the glow of the flames. I looked up into his face and saw the promise spoken in his eyes, as it was in mine.
As long as we both shall live.
Chapter 15. The Flames of Declaration. The great fire below was blazing, damp wood snapping with cracks that rang like pistol shots against the mountainside. A distant gunfire, though, and little noticed through the noise of merrymaking. While she had elected not to be married by the Reverend Caldwell, Jocasta had nonetheless generously provided a lavish wedding feast in honour of Roger and Brianna's nuptials. Wine, ale and whiskey flowed like water under the aegis of Ulysses, whose white wig bobbed through the mob round our family campsite, ubiquitous as a moth round a candle flame. Despite the chill damp and the clouds that had regathered overhead, at least half the gathering was here, dancing to the music of fiddle and mouth organ, descending locust-like on the groaning tables of delicacies, and drinking the health of the newlyweds, and the eventually to be wed, with so much enthusiasm that if all such wishes were to take effect, Roger, Bree, Jocasta and Duncan would each live to be 1,000, at least. I thought I might be good for 100 years or so myself. I was feeling no pain, nothing but an encompassing sense of giddy well-being and a pleasant sense of impending dissolution. At one side of the fire, Roger was playing a borrowed guitar, serenading Bree before a rapt circle of listeners. Closer, Jamie sat on a log with Duncan and his aunt, talking with friends. "Madam," Ulysses materialised at my elbow, tray in hand and resplendent in livery, behaving as though he were in a parlour at River Run, rather than on a soggy mountainside. "Thank you." I accepted a pewter cup full of something, and discovered it to be brandy. Fairly good brandy, too. I took a small sip and let it percolate through my sinuses. Before I could absorb much more of it, though, I became conscious of a sudden lull in the surrounding gaiety. Jamie glanced around the circle, gathering eyes, then stood and held out his arm to me. I was a little surprised, but hastily replaced the cup on Ulysses' tray, smoothed back my hair, tucked in my kerchief, and went to take my place at his side.
"Come, lady,"
he said in Gaelic, smiling at me. He turned and raised his chin, summoning the others. Roger put down his guitar at once, covering it carefully with a canvas, then held out a hand to Bree.
"Come, lady," he said in Gaelic, grinning.
With a look of surprise, she got to her feet, Jemmy in her arms. Jamie stood still, waiting. And little by little the others rose, brushing away pine needles and sand from hems and seats, laughing and murmuring in puzzlement. The dancers, too, paused in their whirling and came to see what was to do, the fiddle music dying away in the rustle of curiosity. Jamie led me down the dark trail toward the great bonfire below, the others following in a murmur of speculation. At the end of the main clearing, he stopped and waited. Dark figures flitted through the shadows. A man's shape stood in silhouette before the fire, arm raised.
"The Mingises are here,"
the man called, and flung the branch that he carried into the fire. Faint cheers went up from those of his clan and sept within hearing. Another took his place, McBean, and another, Ogilvy. Then it was our turn. Jamie walked forward alone into the light of the leaping flames. The fire was built of oak and pine wood, and it burned higher than a tall man, tongues of transparent yellow so pure and ardent as almost to burn white against the blackened sky. The light of it shone on his upturned face, on his head and shoulders, and threw a long shadow that stretched halfway across the open ground behind him.
"We are gathered here to welcome old friends," he said in Gaelic, "and meet new ones, in hopes that they may join us in forging a new life in this new country."
His voice was deep and carrying. The last scraps of conversation ceased as the folk, pushing and crowding around the fire, hushed and craned to listen.
"We have all suffered much hardship on the road here."
He turned slowly, looking from face to face around the fire. Many of the men of Ardsmuir were here. I saw the Lindsay brothers, homely as a trio of toads, Ronnie Sinclair's fox-eyed face, ginger hair slicked up in horns, the Roman coin features of Robin McGilvery. All looked out from the shadows, ridge of brow and bridge of nose shining in the glow, each face crossed by fire. Under the influence of brandy and emotion, I could easily see, too, the ranks of ghosts who stood behind them, the families and friends who remain still in Scotland, whether on the earth or under it. Jamie's own face was lined with shadow, the firelight showing the mark of time and struggle on his flesh, as wind and rain mark stone.
"Many of us died in battle," he said,
his voice scarcely audible above the rustle of the fire.
"Many died of burning. Many of us starved. Many died at sea. Many died of wounds and illness."
He paused.
"Many died of sorrow."
His eyes looked beyond the firelit circle for a moment, and I thought perhaps he was searching for the face of Abel McLennan. He lifted his cup then and held it high in salute for a moment.
"Slange,"
murmured a dozen voices, rising like the wind.
"Slange,"
he echoed them, and tipped the cup so that a little of the brandy fell into the flames where it hissed and burned blue for an instant's time. He lowered the cup and paused for a moment, head bent. He lifted his head then and raised the cup toward Archie Hayes, who stood across the fire from him, round face unreadable, fire sparking from his silver gorget and his father's brooch.
"While we mourn the loss of those who died, we must also pay tribute to you who fought and suffered with equal valour and survived." "Slange,"
came the salute, louder this time with the rumble of male voices. Jamie closed his eyes for an instant, then opened them, looking toward Brianna, who stood with Lizzie and Massali, Jemmy in her arms. The rawness and strength of his features stood out by contrast with the round-faced innocence of the children, the gentleness of the young mothers, though even in their delicacy I thought the firelight showed the seams of Scottish granite in their bones.
"We pay tribute to our women," he said,
lifting the cup in turn to Brianna, to Massali, and then turning to me. A brief smile touched his lips.
"For they are our strength, and our revenge upon our enemies will be at the last the revenge of the cradle, Slange."
Amid the shouts of the crowd, he drained the wooden cup and threw it into the fire, where it lay dark and round for a moment, then burst all at once into brilliant flame.
"Come to me,"
he called, putting out his right hand to me.
"Come to me," he said. "Come to me, Claire, daughter of Henry, strength of my heart."
Scarcely feeling my feet or those I stumbled over, I made my way to him and clasped his hand, his grip cold but strong on my fingers. I saw him turn his head. Was he looking for Bree? But no, he stretched out his other hand toward Roger.
"Stand by my hand, Roger the singer, son of Jeremiah Mackenzie."
Roger stood stock still for a moment, eyes dark on Jamie, then moved toward him like one sleepwalking. The crowd was still excited, but the shouting had died down and people craned to hear what was said.
"Stand by me in battle," he said in Gaelic,
his eyes fixed on Roger, left hand extended. He spoke slowly and clearly to be sure of understanding.
Be a shield for my family, and for yours, son of my house.
Roger's expression seemed suddenly to dissolve, like a face seen in water when a stone is tossed into it.
Then it solidified once more, and he clasped Jamie's hand, squeezing hard.
Jamie turned to the crowd then, and began the calling. This was something I'd seen him do before, many years before, in Scotland. A formal invitation and identification of tenants by a laird.
It was a small ceremony, often done on a quarter day or after the harvest. Faces lighted here and there with recognition. Many of the Highland Scots knew the custom, though they wouldn't have seen it in this land before tonight. Come to me, Geordie Chisholm, son of Walter, son of Connaught the Red. Stand with me, Evan Murdo, you sons of Alexander Lindsay of the Glen. Come to my side, Joseph Weems, son of Donald, son of Robert.
I smiled to see Mr. Weems, flustered but terribly pleased at this public inclusion, make his way toward us, head proudly raised, fair hair flying wild in the wind of the great fire.
Stand by me, Josiah the Hunter.
Was Josiah Beardsley here? Yes, he was. A slight dark form slid out of the shadows to take up a shy place in the group near Jamie. I caught his eye and smiled at him. He looked hastily away, but a small embarrassed smile clung to his lips as though he had forgotten it was there. It was an impressive group by the time he had finished. Nearly 40 men gathered shoulder close and flushed as much with pride as with whiskey. I saw Roger exchange a long look with Brianna, who was beaming across the fire at him. She bent her head to whisper something to Jemmy, who was submerged in his blanket, half asleep in her arms. She picked up one of his wee paws and waved it limply toward Roger, who laughed. Distracted, I had missed Jamie's final statement, catching only the last few words. Whatever he had said met with approval, though. There was a low rumble of solemn assent from the men around us, and a moment's silence. Then he let go my hand, stooped, and picked up a branch from the ground. Lighting this, he held it aloft, then threw the blazing brand high into the air. It tumbled end over end as it fell straight down into the heart of the fire.
"The freezers of the ridge are here," he bellowed,
and the clearing erupted in a massive cheer. As we made our way back up the slope to resume the interrupted festivities, I found myself next to Roger, who was humming something cheerful under his breath. I put a hand on his sleeve, and he looked down at me, smiling. "Congratulations," I said, smiling back. "Welcome to the family, son of the house." He grinned enormously.
"Thanks," he said. "Mum."
We came to a level spot and walked side by side for a moment, not speaking. Then he said, in a quite different tone,
"That was something quite special, wasn't it?"
I didn't know whether he meant historically special or special in personal terms. In either case, he was right, and I nodded. "I didn't catch all of the last bit, though," I said, "and I don't know what Yabsocht means. Do you?"
"Oh, I know."
It was quite dark here between the fires. I could see no more of him than a darker smudge against the black of shrub and tree. There was an odd note in his voice, though. He cleared his throat.
"It's an oath of a sort. He, Jamie, he swore an oath to us, to his family and tenants. Support, protection, that kind of thing."
"Oh, yes," I said, mildly puzzled. "What do you mean, of a sort?"
"Ah, well..."
He was silent for a moment, evidently marshalling his words.
"It means a word of honour rather than just an oath,"
he said carefully.
"Yarbsocht was once said to be the distinguishing characteristic of the MacCrimmons of Skye, and meant basically that their word, once given, must unfailingly be acted upon at no matter what cost. If a MacCrimmon said he would do something...
He paused and drew breath.
He would do it, though he should burn to death in the doing.
His hand